down to a little tank too. It didn't take much, but. Can't tell, and I didn't want nobody to run out.
Oh,
1226.
I tell you. Sure nice to have you come around and
do
show
you
it up.
Set most of the time?
No.
I do. I get out right tonight, but a lot of most time I'm sitting up.
Yeah.
I love to stand up.
Now, mine's running most of the time. Well, of course, when I'm in the office down there, I'm sitting at the desk all the time, but. Like this, I'm out going most of the time.
I'm not. Uh-huh.
1226.
You still, got kerosene over to station now?
Well, yeah, he got kerosene over there. He's selling kerosene there.
I mean, you don't store it over
no.
there? Well, how much does he keep on hand?
Oh, about 500 gallons a time. He doesn't sell that much of it.
Yeah. He just sells it when you run out?
Yeah. Somebody take a can up and get it.
Well, I'm surprised that we hadn't used more than this.
Well, I was here though on the 5th, see.
Oh, that's right.
I knew it hadn't been long enough, but I had to come back here and
well,
check the comparisons, and then I want to check on Bessie down here, and she's still nobody's home down there.
She's in the hospital.
Still in the
hospital. Well, I'm sure I'm glad you came by.
Well, I hadn't heard what she cut out or not, so I'll come back by to check her.
Well, I just let it go until she gets back.
Yeah.
Isaiah is down there. He can handle it, can't he?
Oh, Isaiah burned it up all right.
Yeah.
He just won't pay you for it.
Oh, is that it?
Nah, he wouldn't pay nobody. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh, thank you. Then.
He owed me about $10-$12 in half or 7 or 8 years. I don't know how long. It's been a long time.
He just won't pay.
Well, let me tell you, he had a good garden down there last year. If you'd been up here at the right time, you know, it wouldn't take much to get.
Wouldn't take long to get that much, would
it?
Not
much now, but
that's the truth.
Good to see you.
Okay, thank you now.
Uh-huh, thank you.
To a very thin top there,
yeah.
But that's because the sun hit it, and that
oh.
Thin keeps right on going up much
I
more.
I can see, it's because the sun hits it. It doesn't get thin like
the
that.
Sun
oh,
makes
I see.
It quite.
Yeah. I was going to say that tree might be tall, but it looked like it got to be
yeah,
good sized toothpick up there.
That's the sunlight
mm-hmm.
that stopped it. Well,
I want to see some of these cotton. I want to see this.
Well, the cottonwood is a marvelous tree. Of course, I'm not a qualified man. And so when I mentioned the fact that I was getting interested in cottonwood, the professional boy says, cottonwood's what are they good for? That's the usual reply. Well, I said, they make good crates and hampers, pretty wide baskets for the vegetable trade, and the trade prefers them, and we've cut out our hardwoods now. No one ever concerned himself with our hardwoods in Florida.
Oh, no.
No one, not even today. And this is now 14 years of work. Well, I said we have to import wood from Central America to keep our crate mills going. Cottonwood, if we could grow enough of it, would be a help. And we'd keep that expense down. Never heard of such a thing. Well, it takes time sometimes. I found out that that tree began to grow so fast.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, wonder if they'll grow from cuttings. So I put cuttings in a cutting box and 100% rooted. And 100%. I found out all I have to do is take cuttings and put them in a wet place, moist soil in February, In October, you got a tree from 4 to 6 feet high.
Oh!
As fast as
that.
I had one 9 feet high one time. Then you plant those out. Average height in 5 years, that means I got 250 trees there. Average height. Some are on better soil, some have more advantage in one way or another. Not every tree is exactly the same height, but the average height is 52 feet in 5 years. So now cottonwoods are beginning. The same fella I said I'm getting interested in cottonwoods, I see him now. Oh yeah, cottonwoods. We've been planting cottonwoods. Planted them one. Wouldn't know where to plant them either. You'd probably put them on a blackjack oak ridge in deep sand somewhere where there wouldn't be a damn. You know, there's a lot of people that haven't learned the practical side of things.
Where do you put them?
Put them on moist soil if you want the best growth, but they'll grow most anywhere. But don't put them on dry sand land. Your soil here would grow cottonwoods, but they'd grow much faster on moist soil.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well.
And they're beautiful trees.
Yeah, nice shade trees. I love a cottonwood because out west, when you're walking through the semi-desert, and you come to a little stream, and there's a few cottonwoods down there at the bottom. The stream may be dry, but under the surface there's still plenty of moisture. And you sit down from the hot sun and rest in the shade of the cottonwood, and you hear those leaves fluttering. First thing you know, you're asleep.
Now say that again, Mr. Neil. I'm talking
about the cottonwoods out west. They're a little different species than this cottonwood. I mean the variety.
Yeah.
But you get into West Texas, for instance, where it's semi-desert, or Arizona, or New Mexico, or what's that?
Middle West has them too.
State with Utah.
Oh, they go way
in
out
California.
There?
California. We have about 9 different varieties, I think, of the cottonwoods in this country.
Well, they go clear on out there.
Oh, that's where they grow. That's where you find them. They don't grow this side of Tallahassee. There's a few in West Florida.
Yeah.
So I found this little cutting, this little seedling in a roadside ditch west, about 25 miles west of Tallahassee. There's no other trees near there, but you know the seed drifts through the wind.
Oh, yeah.
And so I took it up, and that's the one you see there. I took it up with
a ball of
mud. Yeah, that's that same tree.
Well, how do you suppose,
good Lord,
Mr. They grow here.
Yeah.
They're growing for you.
Yeah, but I'm not a qualified man, and so they don't admit that anything to cottonwoods. I'm the one that developed them.
Well, how do you suppose cottonwoods never got a start in this country?
How did they what?
How do you suppose it happened that the cottonwoods never got a start in this country?
Well,
they go way on our yonder.
Maybe it takes time. But,
well, I mean, in the old days before people...
Yes, you have a good question there. But the trees of all kinds seem to have limitations in their distribution. And while they'll do all right here, they won't do all right there. But unless you try, you can't find out. Mine seem to be doing fine here, although they're not native this side of Tallahassee. If you see one, it has been brought in mostly from Georgia, Carolina, up in there, where they are more numerous.
Oh, they have one up there?
Plenty of them.
They just don't have them in Florida.
They have them all the way to Canada. And from Canada all the way west, but from all my travels through the western country, you rarely ever see a cottonwood unless it's river bottom land, stream bottom land. There's where you find them along the river.
Well, do they use the wood?
I suggested it as a crate material, source of crate material, because it makes pretty white baskets, crates, and hampers. and the trade prefers them, it helps with sale. So now they have found out, since I started with cottonwood, that certain grades of fine photographic paper, there is no substitute for cottonwood.
And that's what they use for it out west. And
then another use they have found, beautiful white wallboard.
Oh, my.
So now, cottonwood, my friend in Stoneville, Mississippi, where they have this hardwood research, wrote me here a year or two ago and said 100,000 acres of cottonwood is going to be planted in the South in the near future.
Oh, really?
So maybe I wasn't crazy after all.
Cottonwood. But now, a cottonwood is a you like like that tree?
Yes, I like it because it has some memories out west. It shaded me and gave me protection from the hot sun. We had one on the farm that volunteered there. How that tree got to all the streams in our neighborhood had cottonwoods if they were any size of stream. So I got acquainted with the tree there, and when I saw some in West Florida, I said, well, I'm carrying on research in hardwoods. It's not a hardwood, but hardwood is a misnomer. Some of the so-called hardwoods are softer than some of the pines or cedars or other conifers.
Mm-hmm.
So I got interested in cottonwoods, and I'm the one that introduced them, and I don't say it braggingly. I don't care for credit myself. That's just a human failure. But if I'm right in something, I don't like to be ridiculed.
You got to have something that grows fast.
Yeah. You need something to attract the farmer. And you can sell cottonwoods, they tell me now, mine are spaced too close, 4x4.
Yeah.
But now they found out they can use the thinnings as strippers, and there's a market for them. And they just run them through the pulp mill into chips when they're small trees, and you can space them 4x4 for 4 or 5 years without hurting the stand at all, and then thin them. Then you get long, clean stems. That's what forest trees, hardwoods need, long, clean, knot-free, branch-free stems. I asked every forester I knew that I thought might know how to space hardwoods. No one ever planted any in Florida. Maybe up in the northern states, I know a few people did. But this is a new thing.
But they don't plant them up there. They just volunteer.
Up yonder?
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, here too. The area they gave me for my planting was once in hardwoods. That's the reason I asked for it, because I wanted typical hardwood hammock saw. Trouble was they had it cleared, had just been cleared. They had it sodded down with bahia grass sod so thick you could hit it with a hole and it would bounce back. It was so well rooted. Well, no deciduous trees can successfully combat perennial grasses.
And the pine tree can't either.
Not well, no. So
nothing can.
I had to make circles around each tree in order. Work there, 4 foot circles around each tree.
Just so it survive.
Yeah, when you have 1,000 trees to do it for, there's a lot of work in.
You got 1,000 trees?
I did all that work. I did everything out there.
You got 1,000 trees?
I got about 2,000 now.
He does all the work.
Because I added
about
to it.
Days work, yeah.
I'm clearing new ground now, and if you look in this. In this last picture here, this new ground is boggy, and that's where I'm planting white cedar, because it's a bog tree. That's a finding of what nobody knows anything about white cedar. One of the professors out there sent me a letter from a lady who wrote to him and said she wanted the white cedar seedlings. It's not a juniperus. All the cedars are juniperus, but white cedar is camithiferous, different strain of coniferous wood. That's 20 years old, and I got a picture of it in my report. Because all the foresters will say, white cedar, never heard of that. Well, as you can see, you know what I tell them, they wouldn't believe, but what they see, it's a little more difficult to disbelieve. So it is.
And a picture helps.
Huh?
A picture. It helps to have a picture.
Yeah, without a picture, you often, without showing them. You know, you can tell them they wouldn't believe a word of it, but if you show them, it's a little more difficult to disagree with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on my boggy ground, I'm planting water tupelo there. I tried out some years ago.
Is that a poplar tree?
Is that what?
Poplar?
Hardwood tree.
Is
no,
that?
It belongs to the Nissus of the gums. It's called water gum. But I've noticed in the woods, it doesn't grow except in West Florida, but I found one planting out here near Olino, not a planting, but a catch there around the pond. It can be underwater 6 months of the year, 3 feet. Doesn't hurt a tree a bit. Makes a beautiful log.
Well, how does it get air?
It's developed a resistance for high water because it's all the gums are Nyssa, N-Y-S-S-A. Nyssa aquatica is this one. Aquatica means water. And it can develop a way to live underwater part of the year. Don't hurt it a bit. So
well,
these are seedlings that are 1 year from a seedling. And they're up
Lord.
There.
Lord.
This is myself standing by one.
Goodness.
Fast growth.
Well, I see, since I've been out here, the water would come up on these swamps there and stay for 2 or 3 months, and then I'd have a line of dead trees.
Mm-hmm. Nature is always fighting. I often see that. As you go through the woods, you'll see trees out of their element. Nature is testing. Maybe there's been a change through the thousands and millions of years of testing. They keep still trying. For instance, people will say, I'll say, that's too wet for a slash pine there. Well, and up there, 7, 8, 10 feet high, doing fine. Well, comes a time when we have an unusual wet summer, rainy season, and they'll all be dead, and they were, but nature's trying. And you see it between a hammock and a swamp, there's often a grassy place.
Mm-hmm.
And I see a little seedling of oak coming up there. I know it's not going to live there long. Nature trying to see if a little can be added.
Mm-hmm.
Just like us, we seem to be multiplying too.
Yeah, between your hammock and your swamp, you would have that grassy
mm-hmm.
place there where
often you do, yeah.
where everything dies out when
mm-hmm.
the water's up.
Yeah, when the water's up, you're right. But this tree makes a good tree for crate material, and will stand water tables higher than any other tree will.
I'll tell you something that will stand water, wet ground, and that's that old broom sage.
Broom sage?
Oh, it just
thrives.
Yeah. It'll take it dry or wet.
Yes, some plants have a great tolerance of rains. Dry or wet, they'll make it. Through the thousands and thousands of years, nature develops plants for all occasions.
That old broom sage, and but now if you plow it, it's gone. Just turn it up, you see.
If you do what, it's gone?
Plow it.
Oh, yes.
I'll get rid of it.
It's not very desirable pasture plant either.
But that cottonwood is your choice so far out there.
Yeah. Cottonwood grows on very wet soil, but it's one of those trees that's like slash pine. Man out in West Florida had a prairie, and he said he wanted to plant it all up to slash pine. I said, no, I wouldn't do that because that's too wet. Well, I see some down there on the ditch banks, a little creek running through there doing all right. That's wetter still, you know. That's moving more. They'll take that periodically, but when it backs out,
and stands,
it won't do. And kill them. If nature couldn't grow them there, don't you try it, because nature's been trying that for a thousand years.
Yes, it'll be a struggle.
Well, if it grows at all, and often they get about 7-8 feet high, and then an unusually high water table comes down.
But now this old cottonwood, I didn't know they grew so high, Mr. Weaver.
Well, I didn't know much about them either here until I tried. So I have no reputation to lose in forestry, so I can make mistakes. So unless you try, you won't know. And
how high would you say that is?
Huh?
How high would you say that is?
Well, the cottonwood, uh-huh. At least, it's over 100 feet now.
And how old is it?
14 years.
And 100 foot high.
Mm-hmm. 13 years the last time I measured it, but this is the 71 year growing season report, so now it's over 100 feet. I have the heights of the trees all listed here. You know, it takes a lot of time and mileage to go out there 2-3 times, no, 4-5 times a week. And measure trees for stem diameter and height, and that's tedious. There's a lot of work involved there. Here it is. See, there's all the species and all the height the year before and the current year.
Oh.
This isn't written for technicians, this is written for practical people. They don't want you to use technical terms or they won't read it.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be written for farmers or forest land owners.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the School of Forestry doesn't admit that exists.
Yeah. Let me tell you, Phil, I wish they could just walk down that back lane there with Mr. Nealon a little bit and let him and just, you know, do a little field trip there with him.
Well, that would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's getting time to...
Could you just walk down the lane with him and point out a few things to him?
Oh, I'll be glad to do that, but
yeah.
I'll have to be getting back.
I'd be glad to fix you some lunch.
No, I
why not?
Let me tell you, Mr. Nealon.
I'll have to be back home before 12 o'clock.
Okay.
Well, let me tell you, we need a little bit more while you're out here. We need just a little bit more.
A little bit more of what?
I know what I need. Just a little bit more information.
Oh, well, I'll be gone one of these days, fortunately, and... You wouldn't need any information.
Well, they can take a walk down the lane and come back before you leave.
Yes, if you have something you'd like my opinion on, I'll tell you if I think I know, and I'll be equally frank if I don't know. I'll tell you I don't
know.
Let
me tell you, Mr. Nealon, I've been out with you. They haven't.
It's tree identification.
Yeah,
you're
yeah.
Yeah,
tell
them
what you do.
Yeah, just walk down the lane with them, and we'll
yeah,
see
I'll
them.
Yeah, I'd be very happy to do that.
Mm.
I have to learn
you're
every day, too.
You're not a house plant anyway.
No.
Too long inside, not good for you.
I belong in the outer doors, and that's where I'm at, in the woods. Thank you for your hospitality.
We'll see you. Yeah.
Is that not funny?
Yeah.
I hope it isn't snowing out there again.
Yeah.
Better put on some warm clothes.
Yeah.
This is a break. This is a break. Mr. Nealon is taking Debbie and Rick out in the back, in the back pasture. I saw him down at the foot of the back lane on a little field trip just for break. It's 11 o'clock and past, and he says he has to be home by 12. But we have a long session here. We got to work a good bit this Saturday, the 10th of February, 73, and this is a break. Now, we're taking a break. They got him out unstuck, but that was some time ago.
Well, did you see anything?
No, things are all froze up today.
Yeah.
No birds much. Just see one big blue.
Yeah. We're gonna take all this stuff out of the tapes and put it down on paper for you.
What on tape?
Huh?
You didn't run the tape on me, did you?
Well, we've got three or four tapes, don't you remember? We got about
right.
4 hours of it before this.
I would have been more embarrassed than usual if I.
Well, let me tell you. Well, now this is a business proposition, and we'll. You see, I got a little help now. They can beat me. Yeah, and we'll get that in shape there for you, so you can see it. Now we need to go out with you. Spend a half day out there with you. How long do you stay when you go out of that at your trees?
Oh, that's my forest out there. Well, I often stay a half a day then.
Yeah, that'd be all right.
Yeah.
Now could they, Rick, meet you up there sometime and go out with you?
I'd be very happy to have them go out there. Maybe they could tell me something that's good for me.
Yeah.
Like pulling me out of a hole in the road.
That's
or
right.
A ditch.
Well, he's good at that.
You know, you can learn from everybody.
Yeah. And let me tell you, you won't go out there unless the weather clears off.
Yeah, let's make it a good day.
Yeah.
But let's be sure to make a date. Now, yesterday, I had 25 trees to plant on the garden center, and a friend of mine gave me the seedlings, and I dug them up and did the planting, but that was by a prearranged date, and I have many of those, so I can't just go anytime because I've made promises.
And you'd have to look at your... You'd have to look at your calendar to tell when you could get loose.
If I don't mark the calendar, I'll make two dates for the same day.
Yeah.
I don't keep up with it all.
Well, we can find that out. You can check it.
Just let me know the day before when you folks can make it. And if I'm not engaged, then the time is yours.
Well, let's see. When's it going to clear up again? This is Saturday, Sunday. Monday will be clear, won't it?
Yeah.
Let's see, this is Saturday. Yeah, it might be. Let me see. I've got meetings Monday night. The Men's Garden Club meeting Monday night. And World War I veterans in the forenoon that there were so few of us left. If I didn't come, why... They'd be mad.
What's that for?
Well, there are things that World War I veterans can do. You know, they're forgotten men. And we have a hospital there, but the poor people that are crippled, some with no arms, the Veterans Hospital doesn't have personnel. to look after them, and they're the poor fellows sit there all day long, and they can't even feed themselves. Or they may have no legs, and you have to bring them books or newspapers or talk to them. They get lonesome. So
that?
We try to do some of that.
Where is that?
The Veterans Hospital, you know, it's back at the university.
Oh, over there?
Yeah. That's the World War I vet, other vets too, but World War I vets are the ones we're particularly interested in.
Now, what was the other thing? The
Garden Club and, oh, a thousand things. Then my forest, I have to see about it. And collect seeds, and I've got to get some more plantings made where those water tupelos are coming up. And then I've got to go get some white cedar seedlings up in Nassau County where I made a planting so that I can finish that wet ground planting. It's all things like that. Then towards the dairy center last week, I planted 16 trees there because the lane that leads up there had missing trees in it, and they wanted them filled out. Well, I grow some sycamores and some cottonwood seedlings, so I've got this notion. Fella's been on the public payroll all his life, owes the public something, and now I overdid it.
Well, now wait a minute. Now we all get that a little straighter. So you don't know just when you will be out there for half a day at your...
Well, maybe, no, if I, Monday I'm engaged, but after Monday I don't know anything I have to do.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll find out, and when will you go out there? Monday, say Tuesday.
Well, I'll go out there when it suits you.
No, we're going with you. Whenever you're going, and going to work a little bit.
Well.
Oh, he don't want to go out there and just take a tour. He wants to go out there and just do whatever you're doing.
Oh, I see. Well.
You can talk and do and going and coming.
Well, I would like to take up the time. Most of it that would be most profitable to you. I can show you in a minute what I'm doing, but the 16 different species there.
Yeah.
Of course, now there's
that
no
works.
Leaves on the trees.
That doesn't matter about
and,
that.
They're a little harder to identify.
Well.
So you can learn to identify them.
Well, that's what I want to do. Get into those trees.
Well,
see what all there's out there.
You can learn in the forest whether it has leaves or not.
And how they behave out there.
Yeah.
That's the thing.
And how tall they get.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what they told me when I said, do you want to plant some hardwoods? Hardwoods? They grow so slow. I've got some trees out there almost as tall as that cottonwood. Other species,
I want
they
see
don't
that.
Grow slow.
Yeah.
Nobody's ever tried it before, so how would they know? I said, do you ever plant any? How would you know? No one ever planted any, always thought so. Well, these are professional foresters.
Well, now look, Mr.
Don't Dillon. Tell them what you think, tell them what you know.
I tell you, whenever Rick comes up there and goes out there to the your trees with you, Debbie can come along and she can spend a little time with Ms. Needland.
Well, she might be interested. I noticed
she knows
interested
trees.
In trees.
She knows
too.
More than I do about trees. She
you
knows
know,
a whole lot about trees.
This isn't just a one-sided thing in forestry. We need the ladies too to back us up sometimes, even if they don't want to cut them down.
Well, I know, but somebody needs to talk to Ms. Needland a little bit.
She's overloaded worse than I am.
Well,
hospital work. They say that Letchway General Hospital couldn't run without the women's auxiliary.
And she's in that?
And she's in that. She does a lot of sewing for it in addition. So up until 10 o'clock, she isn't writing garden club reports. He's been on the state board for years and years, They finally gave her $100 paid up life membership. You don't get that without work. So she works in that, so she's always buried in things.
Well, now look, if when Debbie goes in there and visits with a little bit, she don't have to stop what she's doing, you see.
No.
She can go ahead with it.
Well, she'd be welcome anywhere, anytime.
Yes. So Debbie, no problem. It's just getting you. You are the problem.
Well, I've been a problem all my life.
We just have to catch you, won't we?
Well, you let me know when you can go.
Tuesday morning. No, no. It's when you are going.
Well,
I just want to tag along when you go to work.
Where, how could I get in touch with you?
Call me.
Just call him. He can get in touch
call
with
you. Call you in at your town?
No, right here.
Are you?
I'll call you. No. I'll keep in touch with him.
Yeah, okay. There's almost always someone home. We go shopping about twice a week, grocery shopping mainly. We have guests often at noon. At least one,
mm-hmm.
sometimes two. So we have to go grocery shopping a little more than we otherwise would. It doesn't take much for us too.
Yeah.
But
now you don't know whether you got some of these trips that you got to take.
I don't have anything on my list for Tuesday.
Okay, I'll check you Monday night.
See if. If I've forgotten some promises
right.
I made, I can't keep up with them all.
All right, I'll check with you Monday night, and you leave word with Ms. Nealon if you're not there.
Yeah, you can talk to her because she can pass on anything that information that I need.
All right.
Bye bye. Hope I won't get stuck. Now I better go around by town.
Yeah, you go down.
I go right by Methodist Church over there, right?
Yeah, you go down by down that way.
This sounds too right, and a continuation of the last part of Mr. Nealon's visit this Saturday, the 10th of February, 7-3, with Rick and Debbie. This Saturday morning, when the Audubon group was coming out, this Saturday morning, the 10th of February, 7-3, with Mr. Nealon, Channel 2 right. I should have started on Channel 1, but I missed it. I started on Channel 2, this Channel 2 right, and the continuation of visit Mr. Nealon this Saturday, 10th February, 73. This is around 700 on Channel 2 right. I'm just guessing. This is Tuesday, the 13th of February, 73, and I'm setting up for Rick and Debbie to report after supper. Rick went with Mr. Nealon this morning to see the trees, his forest, and Debbie to visit with Ms. Nealon, and this is Channel 2 right, around 700 or 800, and I'm setting it up for Rick and Debbie after supper, this Tuesday, the 13th of February, 73.
That's nice. Well, you talked about those trees, right? Oh.
I didn't think I could make contact with them. I just didn't.
Well, I'll tell you, Rick. I believe I need to hear. Did you line that out again?
Well, you know his place is up there on the Millhopper Road. You know, and you go out that way.
I know the old Millhopper.
Yeah, you go out that road.
Yeah.
And the university has its experiment station up there.
And you keep on down to Mr. Bryan's corner.
Yeah, and turn in right there.
Yeah, the university put that hard top in.
Yeah, but it only runs hard top till you get up to their gates, and then it's dirt from then on.
Yeah.
And you go in, and it's these nice plowed fields, you know, just as level.
Now that land in there, that's that San Fernando strip of land through here, and that's the richest land I ever saw anywhere.
Mm. Well, we went on in, you could see it had been turned just so. And he said they're getting ready to plant it as soon as the winter goes away a little bit, planting vegetables.
Mr. Bryant, I saw him there. He used to harvest his trees every 10 years.
Mm.
Uh-huh.
That's how fast it grew.
Well, they've got it pretty cleared now. They cleared it with a bulldozer, I think. We came in, and Mr. Nealon pointed over to this little culvert there on the side and said, "You see that tree there?" And I looked over, and it was this red stake sticking out of the ground, a tree. He said, "That one's about 2 years old." Well, it was a thin tree, no leaves in the winter. So that's a cottonwood that I planted. And I planted one on the other side because I thought it looked kind of bare and needed some. I got permission, but I got them planted. And he's right, it was just as bare as it could be.
That's before you get to his part.
Yeah, that's, you have to turn left and go up a little rise there.
Yeah.
So they'll be shade trees. There's nothing to shade them out and make them grow tall.
Yeah.
We went on up, and he pointed, "You see up there?" And I looked, said, "You see those white trees?" And there were these tall trees, and there are no leaves on them. They're all branches and white and bare. Said, "That's my forest."
Well, that's right. The hardwoods wouldn't have the leaves on them, would
it? Well, we went on up. We went.
Is it conspicuous? No leaves?
Yes, because it's so white. He's got evergreens planted around the border. But you see, he's right next to the hammock, so you don't notice it right away.
Oh, yeah.
Till you get up there. And you drive up the little grassy lane there, and one side's a plowed field where they're going to put vegetables, and on the other side is his forest. And if you look as you go by, you can just see long rows of trees, all of them planted in a row. 6x6 was the plot.
Oh.
And as we went down, he pointed and says, "This is the first planting." And then we got to the middle, and that was my second planting. We got up top, and this was the first planting. And this one's...
You went up.
Right, it was just a little rise.
Yeah.
So this is about 14 years old now. So we pulled on around and got out. And he said, "That's my Chinese chestnut. I got 40 of those in 1955 from the U.S. Forest Service, and I planted those, and then they kind of spoiled me. They sent me 20 cuttings of the American chestnut, and I grafted them." Well, I walked over and looked at the grass. While he was talking, I kind of walked away from him. He said, "Now, I can see you don't want to hear what I say." And I said, "Oh, no, wait a minute. I just don't understand what your grafting is." He said, "Oh, well, I'll show you." And he went into how they clipped it and then put the graft on and wrapped it, and the roots would go down. He said, "But what happened was the stubs, all of them died back about 4 inches, and that killed my grafts." "And you see," he said, "I'd had 16 of those grafts take out of 20, and some people can't get any grafts to take. I think that's some kind of record," he said. "But now they've all gone, and I've just got some of my Chinese chestnuts left." "And you see that one? And there was a big one right near us." He said, "Now that one has nuts. It did in its 7th year.
Hmm.
I guess it must have been 10 feet up, and it branched early, because it was on the outside, on the border. And down his border, he had planted these Chinese chestnuts because they had big leaves, and then he had cedars because they were evergreens. And the reasoning there was, you see, he wanted to keep those trees shaded. That way they'd have to grow up for the sunlight, and their stems would be clean and no knots." And he pointed to them. He said, "Now you see those limbs?" I said, "Yeah." He says, "Now those will drop off. Those will rot away. You see," he said, "you don't get any money for knotty wood. You get paid for smooth wood."
Mm.
Well, we stepped in. He said, "When I asked him for this land, I gave him my plan. I said I wanted to plant hardwoods." And they said, "What do you want to plant hardwoods for? They grow slow." And he said, "Well, what do you know about hardwoods? Have you ever planted them?" They said, "No, that's just what we heard." He said, "Oh." And I told them I wanted to plant mixed hardwoods and ask them for a comment. And they said, "No comment."
I can hear that. I can hear him say that.
Well, they gave him his land and their stipulation there'd be no money. And he said, "You know, in 14 years they've lived up to that contract to the letter. I got this land. It had been bulldozed clear from the hammock. And the hammock was just bordering us. There was a little cleared area between us and the hammock. It was a thick hammock, tall, grown up, never been touched. So they'd bulldozed all this and cleared it, and then it was grassed over with this tough bahia. So I had to clear it myself because my saplings couldn't compete with that bahia, and I had to clear a 4-foot area around all my saplings. And I'd ask them, how do I plant a hardwoods? They didn't know. Nobody knew.
Huh.
So I planted them 6x6. And I looked, and there they were, every 6 feet, a tree all the way down.
And the hare left?
Not inside that forest. Yeah. It surrounded it, but it didn't go in. And he had this, all his woods just mixed, all kinds of hardwoods. He had red oak, red Schumard's oak, and he had the white oak, and he had white cedars, and he had catalpas, and he had cherry. He said, I told them I was going to plant mixed hardwoods. What did they think? And I said, no comment. But you see, I looked around, and that's how nature plants them.
Mm-hmm.
And nature isn't usually wrong. Well, I didn't know why, but I went ahead and planted them. And mixed them in, just random. And then he pointed over, you see that catalpa there? And I looked over, and there it was, and it was maybe 10 feet high with a clear stem, and then it branched out. And it was a good 6 inches in diameter. Said, oh, that one made it. But this one didn't. Well, there was no tree where he pointed. It was a blank spot. And over there was a thin, dead stem. He said, that one didn't make it, and that one over there didn't make it. He said, I didn't know what happened. I could see they were dying, and I finally got a pathologist out here from the university, and he took some soil samples, and he took some samples from the crown root. And in about a month, he called me, and he said it was a kind of root rot. And it spread among that particular tree in the roots, and there was nothing you could do. He says, well, now you see, if I'd had solid catalpa, I'd been lost. So when you mix them, you got a chance. And as it is, that one there was far enough away that no other catalpa roots reached it, and it's lived. And then he stepped over and said, now this is my cherry. And that cherry must have been a foot thick and make over 100 feet up. He said, you know, they said hardwoods grow slow. 100 feet in 14 years. And right next to it was a red Schumard's oak, and it was just as big and just as high. And he said, when I told them I was going to plant red Schumard's oak, they said, what do you want to plant that for? He says, does anybody know anything about that tree? They said, no. So I planted it because I had some ideas. And now I found out from the Wood Institute up in Michigan that that red Schumard's oak has one of the best hardwood lumbers. It is just as durable and just as strong as any there is and just makes fine furniture. Hmm. My red Schumard's oak. And they didn't know anything about it. So we walked on down, and we got down to the other end, toward the north there, and he said, now you see, these are bigger. They're taller. And there sure were. There's another red Schumard's, and it was bigger than the one I'd looked at, and taller. And there was some white oak there. And he said, I didn't think my white oak would make it. You just don't find them east of the Suwannee. But I went ahead and planted some. They wanted me to try, so I put in some. And you see, they're having trouble. They didn't make it down here, but they made it here. Well, it was a thin tree. I could put my fingers, both hands, you know, around it. But it was tall. He says, it's competing. It just might make it. It can get up there where the sunlight is. And you see what it is? The soil's better down here. Hmm. Down there, he said, when they bulldozed, they turned the topsoil and brought the subsoil up. But down here, there's still topsoil left, so these trees are doing better. And then he reached down, he picked up some leaves, and he said, now that's what makes it. That's these leaves make the humus. And he dug away some of the leaves, and there was the soil, and he said, now you see that black? And I looked, and there was this little black soil, and he said, now that's from the leaves. That's humus. And it takes years for those leaves to rot away and make that soil. And I looked over, and that whole forest of his is just a carpet of these brown leaves. And they dry and they crackle underfoot. And he said, but you know, they burn them. That's what the Forest Service does. That's what the foresters say do, burn them. And I said, don't burn them. But they won't listen to me. I'm not a professional. I'm not qualified. But I had an idea about 30 years ago that would stop this burning. And I said, well, that burning doesn't seem to make sense. He said, well, the reasoning behind it is that they're a fire hazard. They're dry. And in a dry time, these catch fires, they'll eat up your timber. They go through these pines. So they keep those burned away, but that kills the soil. And you see, according to Neeland, he says, a tree puts back everything it takes out of the soil. So nature takes care of itself. these people burn away the leaves, then they've got to use that expensive fertilizer, and it doesn't work as well. These trees die, they go back to the soil and rot, and their leaves and everything's put back. So I had an idea about 30 years ago, and I wrote it up in a pamphlet called Timber, Grazing, and Cattle. And I said what you should do is go through there and make lanes 100 or 200 feet wide. You see, he said, I've fought fires. I fought a fire once 2 days straight, and I had nothing but water to drink. We never got anything to eat. We never rested. We went 2 days fighting that fire, trying to put in a fire lane and set our back fire. But you see, the fire came roaring down on us just as our little back fire got going and blew up and blew that burning debris over us and caught it on fire on the other side, and we were surrounded. So my idea was you put in these lanes 100, 200 feet wide, and you set them in strategic places going all through your timberland, and you grass them over. And then you let cattle graze, and that keeps the grass short. So if a fire comes along, you've already got your fire lane, and it's big. And the grass is short, so it won't burn. But they said no. They wouldn't listen to me. Well, he says up in Georgia, there's this fella. And his daddy started it when he had 2,500 acres of land. He wanted pine, and he planted pine. And when he died, his son kept it up. And then the U.S. Forest Service came along and he said, well, we'd like to do research on your land. And he said, fine, you can have it for that. But what you got to do is institute this plan. He said, it was my plan of putting in those fire lanes. And the Forest Service said, no. So he said, okay, you can't have the land. Well, they came back in a few months and said, all right, we'll do that. And he said, okay, then you can have the land for research. And they did it. And then they had a kind of a get-together up there, and he went, and all the forest people were there, and they had a barbecue, you know, and he said we had the grilled meat out in the forest and the little fires and everything. And there was a young fella, and he was going through showing the people what they'd done and showing them these fire lanes. And I walked up to him, and I said, have you ever heard of a pamphlet called Timber, Cattle, and Grazing? And he said, well, yes, we quote from it a lot. And Mr. Neal says, well, I'm the old geezer that wrote it. And he looks at me and said, you see, I'm unqualified. Well, we went on, and he handed me a leaf, an old dried dead leaf, and I had to unfold it a little bit. And he said, that's chestnut. And he handed me another. He said, that's red oak, red Schumard's oak. And then he reached over and he pulled some bark off a sycamore, and he gave that to me. And he said, now it peels every year. I looked over, and he was just flaking off, and the top was almost clean of bark. He said, now the new bark's coming through. And I could see it. The tree was green there, and the new bark was starting to come to the surface. We went on down, and you see, all this time I was thinking, well, you just don't have much land, Mr. Leland. You just have a little old acre. That's all I thought of, a little old acre of land. And here we come down from this bad soil, and we were in this good soil, and then we were walking down. And he said, you see, it's very, very dry up here. But it's a little better down this slope, and down there it's wet. But you see, if you go too far, it gets too wet. And I thought to myself, that's it. It isn't an acre of land. He's got a hill, he's got a slope, he's got low land, he's got land that's too wet, and land that's just wet enough, and land that's dry, and land that's too dry. It's all there, and I never saw it until he looked at it. And we went on down the line, and he said, I want to show you my cottonwood. And we stepped over and says, this is the one that's the picture in my pamphlet. And I started to look. He says, no, stand over here. And then he moved me again. No, stand here. I think you can see it best here. And I looked up, and there it went, just soaring up over 100 feet, this 14-year-old cottonwood. And this was the wood they said when he said he was going to plant cottonwoods. They said, what do you want to plant cottonwoods for? And there she stood. And she must have been a foot and a half in diameter. And that bark was rough bark, and yet it seemed smooth somehow, like it was worn. And I would just think the tree was old. And I said, you know, this tree will be big in about 30 years. And he said, why, in 30 or 35 years, that'll be a log tree. Mm-hmm. And its stem was just as clean and straight all the way up. And he said, now, down there, they didn't grow quite as well, because that's too wet. And I looked down there, and there was wet. I mean, so wet you could see some of the water standing, but it was covered. And there was an old mattress there, and it was rotted and covered with leaves and old cardboard and bits of linoleum and asphalt. And I thought, well, somebody's junking up your property, Mr. Nealon. He said, now, I have so much trouble with swamp grass here. It gets into my seedlings. Said I have so much trouble with the swamp grass here getting into my little sprouts that I have to put down these old mattresses and this cardboard or this linoleum. Anytime I get something that somebody's going to throw away, I put it down, and then I don't have to worry about it. And you see, most of it will just rot away. That mattress there will be gone in a year. Well, I looked over and I noticed that there were all these little stakes. I mean, there was just a series of stakes, and they were in circles. There may be 40 or 50 stakes in these, you know, concentric circles. And he said, you see, I went on vacation, and when I came back, the armadillos had dug up my saplings. They killed them all. So I put these stakes here, and they can't get in there and dig. I have to take care of my saplings. And I looked, and there was this trench running down that side near those saplings all the way up. And I said, and you've put in a little drainage ditch too. And I was thinking he was just making sure the water wouldn't run and eat up his saplings. He said, no, you see those big trees there? And we were right on the edge of that hammock. He said, their roots come in and they'll eat up my saplings. They'll kill them. So you see, a tree feeds 95% on the first 6 inches of soil. So I dug that trench a foot and a half down and cut all their roots on this side. Well, it won't kill the trees, but it does protect my saplings. We followed that trench down, and we got to Little Bluff, and he didn't have a thing planted. And the bluff looked down over that stream, and he said, you see how wet it is here, but you get to this bluff, and it's too dry to grow anything because it drains too much. And then on the edges of this bluff were these two big trees, and they've been girdled. And he'd gone in and chopped all the way around, cut into them a couple inches. And I thought, here's a man who loves trees like this, and he's just cut these to pieces. And I didn't understand. And he said, you see, I had to girdle those because their roots are too close, and they're killing my saplings. But that sweet gum there wouldn't die the first time. I had to girdle it again. We went on down into the very, very wet. And he said, you better follow me now, or you'll get stuck. And he led me in through this wet and up into it was a little drier. Said my cottonwoods didn't make it here, it's just too wet for them. And I tried some red Schumard's oak, and they didn't make it either. But you see, I noticed those tupelo were already here. So that's what I planted, tupelo. And he had 3 rows of those tupelo going out, and they had gone up. They were just 2 years old, but they had gone up maybe 3 or 4 feet. And they were cone-shaped, big at the bottom. And he said, now when they get big, they'll be like a cypress. They'll be buttressed like that. And I stepped up, and he said, careful. And I looked down, and there were these two stakes. He said, that's my sapling. I went, oh, you've got one planted. He said, no, I just noticed that one. Well, I looked, I didn't see a thing. I had to get way down low and brush a leaf away, and there it was, a little sapling, as thick as a pencil lead, and not as high as my finger. And he had these two stakes by it. And I said, Mr. Nealon, how did you ever see this sapling? He said, well, I can... got eyes. I may not be able to hear well, but I can see. I said, Miss Nealon, it's beyond me how you can see that little thing. He said, well, there's another one right there. And there it was, maybe a foot away, a little sapling, and he had two stakes by that one. Hmm. We walked on and through his forest, and we got to the outside edge. And he said, now you see this cottonwood? And it was bigger around than any cottonwood he had. It wasn't as tall, but it was big around. It was a foot and a half, to be sure. I said, how old is that? I said, well, that's 10 or 15 years. He said, no, it's 7. I said, it's 7 years old. This is where the cottonwoods grow good. And he said, you know, I planted 16 of those on the university campus, and I got one of them to grow 18 feet in 1 year. I planted it down at the bottom of the Med Center Hills, just on the left by that little stream, and that soil there is just like the Mississippi Delta, and that's the richest soil in the world. He looked at that cottonwood, and oh, was he proud. And we stepped back, and I looked down the line. You could see all those evergreen red cedars. He said, you know, I had a lady wanted to know about white cedar, and nobody could tell her anything. So they put her in touch with me. And she said she couldn't find the seeds in her white cedar. The birds were eating them. And I said, no, you get your cones just before they sprout open, and there's where your seeds would be. The birds aren't eating your seeds. I said, but you see, they had to get a hold of me because I was the only one, because I've worked with the white cedar. I've planted white cedar. And he looked around and said, well, you know, we learn a little bit here. Huh. And I thought, yes. And I can see what couldn't grow down here in the wet. And I could see what could grow in the dry. I could see that fine soil coming from the rotting leaves. We walked on back up that little rise. And he stopped at his red cedars. And he said, now I've trimmed this here. And you could see all these fresh cuts. And he said, I had to because they would, and I don't want anyone trimming my forest. But you see, this is a lane for a truck to drive down here. So I keep it clear for them. And then I just throw the trimmings into there. And when I first came in here, there were some trees down in there in that wet spot that I didn't want. They weren't part of my planting. So I just cut them down and cut them up in logs and let them lie. And they'll rot and go back in the soil. So we went on back up. And got just about to where the car was, and he stopped. He said, now that is supposed to be a Chinese chestnut. But I'm not sure. That's what the fellow said that gave it to me, a nurseryman. So I put down in my report on the south end, start from the end and count down five trees, and that's supposed to be a Chinese chestnut. But I'm not sure. So when it gets to bearing nuts, you can test it. And that's just in case I'm not around. And we went on back around, and he pointed out some of his other chestnuts, and he lost them. And he pointed way down there. He said, you see that blank spot? That was a chestnut. See that next blank spot? That was a chestnut. See this stump? That was a chestnut. And I look, and he cut it with an axe at a sharp angle, and the wood was all broken and yellowed and rotting. I just kind of set my foot on it. He said, you see, they got mushroom root rot. I said, there's nothing you can do about that? He said, no, it's in the roots. And I'd go from one of that kind of tree to another. And that one right there, he said, we'll probably go next. I've lost one about every 2 years. Hmm. Well, I looked at the tree, and it was, I could just maybe barely get my both hands around it. And it was way taller than I was. I said, there's nothing you can do? He said, no, I can't. But I think that'll be the last one I lose, because that one down there is a little bit too far for the root rot to get to it. It's passed by the roots. And he thought, and he said, you know, you remember that tree I showed you before we left the house? And I said, yeah. And it was a kind of a cedar. They used to call it a stinking cedar. And what he had done is taken some leaves and crushed them up and put them in my hand, and it had kind of a pungent odor.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, now, in Pensacola, it's the only place you'll find it, and it's almost extinct now. And he had a couple planted there in his little forest, but they were only about a foot high. Said they died there. I knew they were dying. I told them they were dying, but they wouldn't come look until half of them were dead, and then they couldn't save them. He said they all died. But I went back there, and I walked among all those dead trees. Did you know what I found? I found one growing, just a little one.
Hmm.
And I got to thinking, what it is, it must be like some of these parasites. When you kill the thing that you're living on, then the parasite's going to die too. And I thought, well, maybe that's what happened. Maybe that fungus killed all the trees and then had to die. And somehow this other one got started again. But his hickory hadn't been so lucky. He said the hickory pruner's gotten it.
Well,
I looked at the hickory pruner. And I looked at the hickory, It was just a little stick, about the size of my thumb, not quite as tall as I was, and it was clipped, just clipped as neatly as it could be right there at the top. And I thought, well, hickory pruner. I didn't know what he meant. I thought maybe someone's malicious, they're cutting his hickories. And he said it comes in, and it girdles around that top, 2 feet down from the top, and then lays its eggs. I says, its eggs? He says, yeah, it's a beetle. And it just chews away until it cuts that top off, and then it lays its eggs in the dead wood, and then hatches more beetles. And he pulled a little stem over to me that hadn't been cut so long ago, still a little green. And you could see it had been nibbled away all the way around, just very level, except in the middle. And there was a little tuft of wood sticking up where the branch had gotten weak and broken off. And he said, now that's what they do. And they've got most of my hickories. So we went on back out of his little forest. And I thought how marvelous that was. I'd never paid attention to it. I thought it was just part of the hammock land. And there it was. And he could see all those things, the difference in land, and all those trees he had planted. And he said, well, they might call me a fool, but there it is. And I can see that when I'm gone.
So he's a man that's got a forest.
His own forest. And you know, he's planted every tree in that forest. He knows how much they've grown. He knows what's hurting them. I mean, it's his own personal forest. He knows everything about that little area of land. And he spent 14 years watching it grow. And he spent 14 years proving everybody wrong. And he's tucked over in the corner there. Just as proud. And then I thought, you know, I went through and I touched all the trees. I just had to touch all the trees. It's like people walking out wanting to pat all the cows. And then it dawned on me after a while, I'm petting all these damn trees. And he just walked around with his hands in his pocket and just looked at them.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. Just looked at him. It'd be nice to see it with his eyes, wouldn't it? But you worked up, too, that
cottonwood.
Cottonwood.
Yes, you know, I couldn't wait. I'd seen the photograph. And he showed me cherry and red Schumacher oak and these poor trees that weren't making it. And the old magnolia that was a little bigger than I am, but spindly and a few leaves. And he said it might make it, but I don't think so. It can't compete. It's been shaded out. And I kept waiting for this cottonwood. And I just about had to bump into it, you know. And he said, and let me show you my cottonwood. And there it was, just way up there.
You wouldn't look that way.
No.
Well, now, all that time, you were in the forest.
Yes.
So all you could see is what he showed you.
That's right. It's shady in there. I thought, what a great place for a picnic. Your own forest. Now, this was just an old little hill. I mean, it was just grass at one time. And he started out there hoeing away in the sun, keeping the grass down so his little saplings would make it.
And he did all the work.
He did all the work.
That's swamp grass.
Yes, that swamp grass will overtake a sapling and kill it. I mean, a tree comes up, it's little. 6 months and it doesn't get as tall as my finger.
I wonder if we have any swamp grass out there. I don't know exactly what he's talking about.
Well, among all the grasses, I couldn't tell, but it looked like a long-bladed grass. He had some, looked like a little clover, cover crop-like. But I think it was that long-bladed grass that was growing in there. Dark green.
Dark green.
Well, fairly. It was a good, strong green. You wouldn't think you'd have that green in the winter. Now, the thing that struck me was whether that tree lived or died didn't seem to upset him. He would just say, but you see, we learned some things.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at his, he tickled me. I thought he was pulling my leg at first. He looked at his catalpa and it was about 12 feet high before it branched out any. He said, now you see, that's a good fence post tree. You buy the creosoted post, they're creosoted under pressure, but they don't get it in the center, and they rot out, and they break off. But you don't have to treat the catalpa, and it'll outlast it by a long shot. He said, now there's two fence posts in there. That's worth $3. $3 in 14 years, that isn't bad. I thought, well, that doesn't sound like much. And then I found out that you grow a tree for a telephone pole, you grow that pine, you grow that 35 years, and you just, and you happen to pay $50. So he's not really doing a bad exchange. Not bad at all.
But the catalpa has grown enough for fence posts.
Yes. It was the size of a medium-sized fence post. And you could cut it, and then cut it in half, and you'd have two good fence posts. And you wouldn't have to treat it. Stick it in the ground.
Well, you see, the state nursery put out catalpas one year. And none of them live. I put out a whole bunch of them here.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them gone.
Mm.
You see what's left of some of them out there. And they were huge when I got them. Just, they'd grown so fast.
Mm-hmm.
As sprouts, seedlings,
mm-hmm.
whatever you call it. And then I put them in and they just shot up. And then they quit.
They must be susceptible to that root rot.
Mm-hmm.
They got his.
That's a shame. The way they grow,
mm-hmm.
is just a shame.
Yeah.
Now that's funny, that that white oak.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem quite.
It just doesn't
like it.
Compete with the
and the red oak,
fast growing thing.
It grows pretty fast, but I guess it's not suited in that area. East of the Suwannee, he says. I told him it didn't grow east of the Suwannee. I hadn't seen it, and you know, he could tell you just where he's seen all these stands of trees.
Yeah.
Just where in the county.
Yeah.
And where he's planted. And we drove out, and I looked on our way out, and there was this land planted in pines. And I thought, well, look, they planted pines there. And he said, yes. But you see, they planted them because the government pays them. But you see, this land is so close to town that in no time it'll be sold for development, and the trees will all be cut down. They haven't really, they really weren't interested in planting trees.
Mm-hmm.
And his front yard. The streets have cut his house down. He doesn't have much lawn. But every bit of lawn he's got, he uses. And he's got those stake gardens everywhere because the dogs dig up his plants. No dog better get in there anymore because there may be 100 stakes around one plant. And you go down, and in between the curb and the sidewalk, I figure this foot of soil in width. And I would never think it'd be deep enough for anything. And it's solid. He's got wildflower. He's got the grazing grass they have out in California as a border. You go around and there's this big tree, and that's his stinking cedar, as they called it. He's got his pots all set out with his bluebells, and they're all coming up, little blue flowers. And you can see them. There are the pots sunk down in the soil. And he's got a little box over there of parsley. He said I had to grow a box of parsley for somebody. And you go around, and you got a cork tree. Where do you find a cork tree? And I peel off the bark, and it was cork. He said, now if they get big, this isn't a good place for them to grow. Most of them grow around in western Florida, he said, Pensacola. He said, and then they just cut big sheets of cork off them, and it doesn't hurt the tree.
Awesome.
And there were plants in that yard you'd never see anywhere else but at Mr. Nealon's house or California. And he had some trouble with these ones. They would never bloom, but he brought back some California soil and he said, you know, I put them in there and they bloomed right away. And inside his house, he had what looked like It was like a dish case. It was the curved kind with a glass in the front and on the sides. He said, that's my little museum. And up top, he had these two seed cones cut in half, and they were just full of little holes and little seeds sitting in them. And then in the first shelf, he had a horseshoe crab and a little vial full of salt that I guess came from California. Another little vial full of shark's teeth he'd gotten from, you know, the rivers and things around Florida. And then he had, in the next one, he had boxes full of little bird eggs. Old, old birds, old boxes, you know, wooden boxes, and they're all dusty and yellowed. And he said, now I've given so many away from the museum to the big museums here, I don't have many left myself. And there were feathers and plumes all back in there.
He's trying to get
it. And there'd be these little bird nests still hooked to the limb. You can see where they clipped the limb and taken the bird nest. And then down below that, he had a whole shelf of just seashells. So that's my little museum. I looked over, and there were these rattlesnake. He must have had six or seven of them in there. And I looked, and I said, you have got rattlesnake rattles. Yes, but I've had to give most of them away. You know, these little kids come in, and they just want one so bad, and I have to give them one. And I just got so tired of stepping on those rattlesnakes and getting them like that.
Some of them were about this long.
Having one come up beside me.
Step on one of them.
No baby rattlers.
But I guess Debbie saw more of the inside of the house than I did.
What was that thing about the plaque when he came back, Rick?
Oh, yes. You know, every time he'd say something, he'd say, now, but I'm not bragging. He didn't have to say that, because I knew he wouldn't. There were the trees. He didn't have to say, I'm bragging about my trees. Nobody said they could grow, and they would. Because I knew he wouldn't. They grew. He proved it. But he came back, and he finally said, but you know, after 14 years, and I was always fighting him. It's been a hard life. I was always fighting him. After 14 years, they called me back to the Forest Service, and they said they have a plaque for me. I said, well, you've got the wrong man. He said, no, we've got a plaque for you. He said, I'll show it to you when we get home. I'm not bragging now. I don't keep it out because I don't like to show off like that. I don't even know where it is. And he didn't. We got back and asked his wife, and she went in, knew right where it was, pulled out a manila envelope and slid out this plaque. Beautiful polished wood with this metal plaque on it, and had a tree there. It was like the stump of a tree where you cut it, you can see all the rings and everything. And then it said, to T.L. Nealon, for a lifetime of devoted service to the forest, etc., presented a lifetime membership in the U.S. Forest Service. And then it had in quotes at the bottom, the old pine knot. I said, the old pine knot? And he said, yeah. They'd go to say something, and I'd say something about it, and said, oh, that old pine knot, you can't get his approval on anything.
How do they call him that?
I never heard him say that until Saturday. I don't believe
it. I never heard him say it.
The whole time.
Call him like that.
I imagined his forest to be just acres and acres and acres and acres and acres. I just imagined it to be huge.
It seems like it when you get in there. Doesn't have to be 1 acre or anything. He's got it all there.
Uh-huh. Well, Mrs. Nealon said that he used to go out and water the trees himself. So I guess I should have taken that as a clue that it wasn't too big, because if it had been 1,000 acre... Forest, he couldn't possibly have watered all those trees himself. But she said in the summertime he used to look at the sky and say, well, we haven't had rain for 3 days, and then he'd go out and water, carry buckets of water to all those seedlings, and they were growing.
Dry weather, he'd have to help them out a little bit.
Yeah. He sure did. I think the thing that, well, Mr. Nealon took us around the wildflowers. He was, they didn't understand that I was going to stay with Mrs. Nealon. That we didn't, somehow that didn't quite get across to them. And so I used my ankle as the excuse, which was absolutely the wrong thing to do, because they both took me into the, into the dining room and got one of the easy chairs ready, and Mr. Nealon went jumping through all the magazines to have these magazines for me to read so that I, you know, would be comfortable while they were out in the forest. And I didn't want to say, well, I didn't come here to read your magazine. But I had, he took us around the outside of the house before he and Rick went out, and I think the thing that I found the most touching about all of that was the range grass planted around the flower beds. The range grass, the cattle range grass from California. And I just thought, you know, it's the commonest thing he could possibly have brought back. It was sort of like bringing back 100 pounds of soil. It was, you know, he really loves the land. And Mrs. Nealon sort of gave me a picture of that, of how much he loves the land. She took me out to see the flowers again, and the bluebells, the little blue flowers, he told us what the name was, and I've forgotten. There's seven varieties, and they're in different colors, and some of them are vines and climb, and I said something about, we'd ask Mr. Nealon if those were the bluebells, and he said, oh yes, these are his bluebells that he bought.
You gave us the Latin name first.
Yes, that's, and he gave us the real name of them too, which I can't remember.
The Latin name.
Yeah. But a common name too, and then said those were his bluebells, and so Mrs. Nealon and I looked at them, and I said, these are the bluebells, Mr. Nealon's favorite flowers, and she just laughed, and she said, those aren't really bluebells. That's just what they called them. She said that he and his brothers, he really loved that land in California. He said, when we go back, he just paces up and down on the land, and he can tell you where there's a ridge in the land and where the trees are and where such and such an animal lived. And she said, I've never seen anything like it, that he and his three brothers are all the same way. They all just love the land. And she said, I'm not the same way. I like the out of doors, but I don't have the feeling for the land that he does. I grew up in a city, and I just don't have the same feeling. And she said that the land was like their recreation, that they went to school, and then they came home from school, and they worked on the farm. They worked in the groves, or they worked in the orchards. And the only recreation they had was to go hunting on the weekends. These four boys, and they would kill what they ate, the meat that they ate. And she said that, so they the four of them learned everything there was to learn about the foothills of the mountains. They learned all the trees, they learned all the flowers, they learned all the birds, they learned all the animals, but they gave them their own names. So they called these flowers bluebells, that aren't bluebells at all. That's just what they called them. And they gave names to all the birds, and it's sort of like Adam in the Garden of Eden naming the animals, I thought. You know, it's just, they named everything. And the reason, as she saw it, that they loved the land so much was that this was, she said recreation, but it was, you know, it was a little more than that, I think, for them. This was their whole outlet. But she was really cute about, she said, I always just loved the out-of-doors. She said, I grew up in the city, and you don't see very much of the out-of-doors in the city. You have to sort of peer up around the skyscrapers to see the sky. And she didn't say until about halfway through the morning that it was New York that she'd grown up in. I didn't ask her. First, I knew it was New York. I didn't ask her for a while. She just called it the city. There was no other city in the world but New York. She said that she'd always just liked the sky and liked the trees, and she said, no one else in my family was that way. She said, one time I can remember I was walking with one of my sisters, and it must have been in Central Park, somewhere where there were trees, and she said, I looked up at the sky, and it was a beautiful day, and there were clouds and beautiful trees all around, and I turned to my sister and said, look at that beautiful tree, and she said, my sister turned and looked at me and sort of put her nose up in the air, and she said, tree's a tree and a cloud's a cloud. I don't see what's so exciting about that. And walked off. And she said that so she didn't really have too hard an adjustment to make when she moved down to Florida. They lived for 9 years on a farm in Flagler County when Mr. Nealon was county agent. And she said, I guess I just sort of took to living outdoors. I'd never done it. I'd always lived in the city. But I just sort of took to it, being outside. And she said, and I've always just sort of been adaptable to everything. I can adapt to a new situation. I thought that was so cute. She said, you have to be able to adapt in this world. And I, the only thing I had to sort of, for a lead with Mrs. Nealon was her clubs. He said that she belonged to a lot of clubs, and so I asked her, which clubs she was involved in now. I think I mentioned the garden club, and she said, oh yes, that she'd been a member of the garden club here for 40 years. She thought she was probably one of their oldest members, and she said, now that sounds like quite an accomplishment, but actually it's not so much fun because they think I'm an old timer and so they call on me for everything. She said, just the other day this girl called me up and she said the garden club runs a short course, I guess in horticulture over at the university every year. And this girl called me up. She was chairman of the short course committee, and I was on her committee, she said. But she wanted me to write a history of the short course. Well, I just got a little irked, she said. I said to her, 3 years ago, the president of the garden club gave a speech in Tallahassee and described the short course and gave the history. Now, what you could do is go to Tallahassee and get the state records, and you'd have the whole history right there. Then she said, well, it wasn't her fault. I couldn't. She was just trying to do her job. So I wrote the report for her. And I wrote it like a newspaper article. I put everything that was important in the first paragraph, and then I just added two other paragraphs. And if they don't want to put all three paragraphs in that manual, they don't have to. They can leave off the last two. Everything that's important is in the first article. And I said, well, yes, that is pretty important to know how to do that, to write for newspapers. And she said, oh, yes. She said, I used to write the reports. She said, it used to be that the papers printed up the minutes, I guess, or everything that went on at all these club meetings. The paper did it, the daily paper. She said, I used to write up the reports on the International Relations Committee for the University Women's Club. She said, that was really something, because those props would really let their hair down. She said, I had to be very careful what I said. I wouldn't get the professor mad at me, or I wouldn't get the university mad at me. And then she said, she dropped the bombshell then. She said, of course, that was just right before World War II broke out, so you can imagine things were pretty hot and heavy. And I just got all excited, and I said, oh, Mrs. Nealon, do you have some of those articles? I'd love to see them. And she said, oh, no, I don't have any more. I tried to get her to talk about it a little more. It'd be wonderful to have some of those articles, those newspaper articles that she wrote. And
yeah, you know she's got them all laid away.
I'm sure she has them somewhere, but she didn't stick on that, and she said no, she didn't have them. That they just had too many magazines and things around. She said it was mostly conservation magazines and things like the Audubon magazine, and she said that Louis wouldn't throw anything away, any of those magazines. And she didn't really want to throw them away, but she sure would like to get them out of the house. So what she liked to do was give them to people who could use them. And she said one of the magazines, there was an article about some particular species of bird that some friend of hers was interested in. She said, now see, that's a good use for it. I can give it to her, and the magazine won't go to waste. And she had that same thing about not wasting that I saw in Mrs. Rice in Europe. She, in the kitchen, her son was coming to lunch, and so she kept going into the kitchen and coming out again, and then eventually we ended up in the kitchen, and I sat on the stool in the kitchen, and she cooked, because her son has a job that involves traveling, and he comes to eat lunch with them a couple times a week. And she'd made pudding for lunch, and she'd washed the dishes in this big dish pan, and the water wasn't dirty, so she took it out, and it was hot. She said, "I always wash dishes," and she boils the water to wash the dishes. They have hot water in the tap, but it's not hot enough. So she boils the water to wash the dishes in, and she takes the dish pan and puts it up on top of the gas stove like this to keep it hot till after they finish eating lunch so she can wash the rest of the dishes in. Which I thought was kind of a nice touch. she was keeping everything warm on top of the stove. She kept telling me how nice it was to keep things warm. Well, that house must have been 90 degrees because we didn't realize, because we were sitting in the house,
hot
it was. She had all the heaters on, the heater like this, an electric heater, something else. It must have been. And then I was sitting in the sun in the kitchen.
Top of that stove was crowded.
Oh, yes. There was the pot roast for lunch, the dishwater, the tea, everything was up there. She'd cook it on the stove and then just move it up to the warmer and keep it warm. But I think I really saw today for the first time, I've listened these many weeks now to hearing you talk about people making contact. And I think today was the first time I really saw that happen. I knew what it meant, but I never saw it happen until today. We got to talking about the farm, when they lived on the farm. I don't know why particularly. I mean, she had plenty of things to talk about from that time, but I sort of stuck on the farm, and I kept asking her about it, and kept saying things like, "Well, back in Flagler County," and she finally picked it up, and she told stories about it, and she kept saying, "And you know, I had some pretty good experiences." And she just got all excited, and she kept telling me story after story of things that had happened on the farm in Flagler County, because here she came, this girl from New York City. She'd never been out of the city, and she moved to this farm and started living there. And I think I asked her if she'd learned to milk cows, and she said, well, no, she'd never learned to do that, but she took care of the chickens, and they had an incubator for the broodies, the little chicks. But it wasn't a very good one, and she'd have to go out every morning, and some of them, they'd cluster together for the warmth, and some of them would smother, the little tiny chicks. And she said that she felt so badly about that, but there was just nothing they could do about it, and every night they'd lose a couple. But she said even with that, they had enough eggs to sell after they raised that many eggs. And she said then one day when she was home alone usually on the farm, and because Louis was out being county agent, and he came in one morning, and she said to him, "Louis, I've killed an owl." And he said, "What?" And she said, "Well, I heard this great big commotion down in the chicken house, and I went out, and I had on my rubbers. Everybody in Florida wears rubbers in the rainy season," she said to me. "And I went dashing down to the barn, only it was no little distance. It was like from their house to Kirby Smith School, which is two or three city blocks. She went down to the chicken house, and there was this big bird in there, and she said, I had my rubbers on so he didn't hear me coming. I snuck up on him, and I grabbed a tuber fore, and I whacked him aside of the head and killed him." She said, "Louis went down and looked, and he came back, and he said, that wasn't any owl you killed, that was a hawk." Big hawk. And he brought back the chicken. The hawk had killed one of the chickens before she'd killed it. And so then he gave her the chicken. Its head had gotten bitten off, and got in the car the truck or whatever he was going around in with this French-Canadian neighbor that they had, and went off. And she to do his rounds, I guess. She didn't say what he was going to do, but she said, now this French-Canadian neighbor had a mother who was living with them who spoke French. Well, I'd had French and German in college, and so I was the only person around there who could speak a little bit of French with this woman. So she used to come over to see me quite a lot, and she'd get in the rocking chair and just rock like this. And she told me her name, but I've forgotten. I didn't remember it. And this woman would just rock and talk all day. She said, lo and behold, about 20 minutes before dinner time, this woman appeared and sat down and started rocking away. And So Mrs. Nealon just went on fixing lunch and fixing dinner. And after a while, this woman looked at her and she said, you're going to have chicken pie for lunch. Oh, no, Mrs. Nealon asked her if she'd